From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I do want to emphasize, I'm really not involved. People say, well, Governor, you must be involved in these races. I'm really not involved in races.
And when legislative district boundaries are skewed to benefit the party with the power to draw the maps, potential public servants don't even bother to run for office.
The amendment is a clear product of Republican thinking, and it's designed to empower Republican thinking, and part of it is the repeal of the Illinois Voting Rights Act, which minorities are very much in favor of.
Speaker Michael Madigan talking there about a redistricting referendum, an effort in Illinois that apparently won't be on the fall ballot. Also in there, you heard from Governor Bruce Rauner. He says he's keeping a hands-off approach to elections. Doesn't always seem that way, though. We're going to talk about that and more today on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler. He directs the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also today, Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio, and Brian Mackey, IPR reporter. Our guest is Andy Maloney. He's the State House reporter for the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Andy, good to have you on again.
Hey, good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with that Illinois Supreme Court thing, just kind of some housekeeping there. We already had reported before that the state Supreme Court had decided that redistricting referendum did not pass constitutional muster, would not be on the fall ballot, but there was a request for them to reconsider that decision, and it sounds as though the justices pretty much put a nail in the coffin this week. Andy, can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, sure. As you indicated, they denied a motion to rehear that case, and that's not unexpected. In fact, I haven't seen in my time here one of those petitions granted, I don't think, and I believe the one that was most recently granted was about a decade ago. So this is something that is, again, not out of the ordinary, but it did give sort of the parties involved, the governor and, of course, the independent maps people who supported the amendment, another chance to talk about it. The Supreme Court denied that earlier this week, and apparently it fell along the same lines that they denied sort of the substantive appeal on, the party lines. We had a note basically from the court that said the three justices who ran and got onto the Supreme Court as Republicans again dissented and were going to come out with additional dissents at some point. But we haven't seen those yet. So again, sort of the, as you said, a nail in the coffin for redistricting, at least for the near future.
For those that haven't followed this that closely, or maybe aren't attorneys, what was the basis for saying that this shouldn't be on the ballot?
Yeah, it was overly broad. The state constitution basically has some narrow parameters that that citizens' initiatives can try to get on the ballot and be approved and amend the Constitution. They have to be structural and procedural, basically, changes to the legislature. And so anything sort of going outside that framework, anything that touches on something outside of the legislative article in the state Constitution has been deemed to sort of not fall within that framework. I think there's only been successful sort of iteration of a citizen's petition changing the Constitution like this, and it was the cutback amendment back in 1980. Former Governor Pat Quinn obviously involved in that, reducing the size of the legislature. So it's sort of narrow parameters that that citizens can try and change the Constitution.
And the objection that the Democratic majority hit on was the fact that this new proposal would add the Auditor General to the redistricting process, having him vet people who were going to be on the panel that ultimately chose the people who drew the map. And the court said, well, the Auditor General is not mentioned anywhere in the legislative article. As a matter of fact, he's in the finance article. And there were also changes to the role of the Attorney General and to the role of the court itself in contesting maps going forward, but the majority didn't address those. The minority did, in the opinion by Justice Carmeier. He struck down all of those objections. He would have approved it. But the majority, in the opinion by Justice Kilbride, said, we don't have to get into all of that other stuff because we find this issue about the Auditor General dispositive, meaning that this is a situation where if one thing's wrong, it all goes.
And I am interested
People have wondered, after 2 years ago, there was a similar effort thrown out by a Cook County judge who noted, well, you're imposing new conditions for people who want to run for elected office, including the governorship, on folks who serve on this redistricting panel. That's changing the eligibility requirements, and that's in the executive article. So you're outside the legislative article again. And so, as I say, you wonder if at least some of the people who purportedly were backing this proposal, not the goo-goos, the good government types, but some of the pals, were thinking, hey, if the court shoots this down, we can blame the Democratic majority, and it's all Mike Madigan's fault, and it gives Bruce Rauner an issue to talk about so he doesn't have to actually talk about the problems facing the state with the budget.
Well, you're right, Charlie. The redistricting question is not going anywhere. We, of course, have already heard Governor Pat Quinn, who is very much back on the public scene and doing all he can to get media coverage in various ways, and this is one of them. He has a redistricting plan. Republicans themselves have other efforts. There are a bunch of theories as to, is this a way for that, you know, the drafters of this constitutional amendment purposefully included that so they could string the effort along, as you noted, and try and keep this as something that they could whack Democrats over the head with in campaigns and prolong this as an issue. There's very much that theory. So what I was going to say is that I'll be interested also to read what the dissent is from these this minority of the justices who were the ones elected as Republicans, given how vociferous really they were in their original dissent on the question, what it is that they are going to say, if anything, about the political process or what have you, in terms of the rejection of rehearing this case. All that you got was, I think it was six words, basically, from the majority of the court, those who were elected as Democrats, and saying, we've denied the petition to rehear this case. That was it. And whatever it is, it was clear, like I said, in reading the original dissent, that the remainder of the court has some very strong feelings about that decision and the fact that it hasn't come out still and didn't end that very day. What exactly are they going to say, and what does that mean for any future efforts?
Yeah, I would just add, though, after Justice Bob Thomas sounded the death knell for democracy in his prior dissent, I find it hard to imagine that he would have much more strident to say than that, right? Or that would be that much,
yeah,
you know, more
point.
Terrible.
Good
well, I've been around a long
it
time.
On the other hand, Justice Carmeier's dissent was very well reasoned, very well thought out, very well written.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the independent maps people asked the court for a roadmap. Well, what can we do? Justices typically don't do that, and so it seems like the dissenter and Justice Carmeier, as you pointed out, Charlie, tried to do that somewhat. It's hard to imagine that without the composition of the court changing, that will really matter. But, you know, that is what dissents are for, is laying out, you know, justices change, you have changes in court personnel, and maybe a decade or two down the line, if this were to come up again, you know, there are instances where you can say, well, this was a dissenting view and things have evolved and now we think that this should be the majority view.
So, and I would argue that whether or not redistricting fits within that narrow window, there's no question about that. As a matter of fact, the majority opinion recognized that you can do redistricting. It's fair game, as Judge Mikva said 2 years ago. But you have to do it within the parameters of the Constitution. As a matter of fact, in the debate on the floor, the question was specifically put, with this initiative, are you thinking about the size of the legislature, cumulative voting, apportionment, which was what redistricting was referred to commonly 40-some years ago? And the answer was yes, exactly. That's what we're thinking about. We trust the legislature to amend all the rest of the Constitution, but lawmakers are human beings. And when their own self-interest is involved, we want some outside agency to have the opportunity, the citizenry to have the opportunity to deal with the structure and procedure of the legislature. I mean, I'm paraphrasing what the explanation was, but so it's clear you can do a citizen's initiative. You just have to keep out all the extraneous stuff.
Well, while we're talking about the court system, let's move on to a candidate for Congress in Central Illinois, David Gill. He's run several times before. This time he wants to run as an independent, but he failed to get enough signatures as required by law to get on the ballot. Andy Maloney, you have been following his case as well. What is the latest there, and why should people maybe outside of the 13th Congressional District care about this case?
Yeah, well, he, as you said, rounded up signatures, ended up not having enough valid ones, and then filed a case basically arguing that for third parties and independent candidates, they have to get so many more signatures than the sort of established party candidates, and that is unconstitutional. First Amendment, 14th Amendment, freedom of political association, those types of claims. And so local judge or central district judge preliminarily said, you know, your case has merit. You've shown, even though you didn't get enough signatures, you've shown that you did get a lot of them, and you've shown that you have some support. And so we're going to prevent basically the State Board of Elections from enforcing this signature requirement. Now, a three-judge panel at the Circuit Court of Appeals, the Seventh Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, basically blocked that decision and said, no, the district judge's decision allowing him on the ballot shouldn't go into effect, basically. And so now Gill is attempting to get that overturned by a 10-judge panel, the full circuit, and arguing that motion basically was incorrect. So there are some constitutional issues here. Basically, Gill also claims that this is sort of an incumbent protection scheme. He cites some debate when legislators passed this higher minimum signature requirement, and basically saying it's unfair. So if it is ultimately held to be unconstitutional, obviously it'll have some further reaching effects and things that affect more than just the 13th Congressional District.
Yeah, I would add to what you said, Andy, that this should be disappointing to anyone who is not happy with the current two parties we have now. I mean, this has been a year of independent candidates, whether Bernie Sanders' insurgency within the Democratic Party or Donald Trump within the Republican Party. We've seen in Illinois the Green Party has done well in the past, but particularly in Illinois, and Illinois is an outlier in this, it's very difficult to get on the ballot if you're not a Democrat or Republican. You said a lot more signatures. I think it was 15 times as many signatures that an independent candidate has to get. Gill himself said in his court documents that he personally collected almost 5,000 signatures. That's more than five times as many as the Democrat and Republican had to collect altogether, is something 740. So if you like the idea of independent candidates, not Democrats and not Republicans, this should be disappointing to you.
And Charlie, this...
Well, and it all circles back to redistricting, I think, where once you're in, you're in. There's the power of incumbency, there's redistricting, there is the signature requirements. In so many ways, the political system, particularly in Illinois, is set up to reward politicians themselves, and then that can be perpetuated.
Charlie, let me go to you on this before we move on to another topic. But this has been around for a long time, and people have made the same arguments for a long time. And I haven't seen people storming the State House with pitchforks and torches and things. So he may have a valid point that it's incumbent protection, certainly. At the same time, is there a valid reason for why they have this?
Aside from protecting the interests of the two major political parties, I suspect the reason that would be advanced by those who support this system is that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are statewide organizations. They have members and party apparatus from one end of the state to the other, all sections of the state. They participated in state politics in the case of the Democrats, going back almost to statehood in the case of the Republicans from the mid-1850s. And so they've established themselves. And they, therefore, should have more of a, what would you say, an advantage, or should be given less burdens to get on the ballot, whereas somebody who's, Charlie Wheeler, who's coming along as the Coca-Cola candidate should have to work harder to get on the ballot. Now, as a matter of fact, I believe it was 2006 when Rod Blagojevich ran for his second term, the Green Party candidate, Rich Whitney, got enough votes, if you're on the ballot as an independent or as a third-party candidate, and you get 10% of the vote for governor, then your party becomes an established party. And so the next couple of elections, the Green Party was an established party because Whitney got more than that 10% of the vote. And then in the subsequent elections, Green Party went back to where it always has been, with maybe 2%, 3%, and it's no longer an established party.
It's got to continue that through each gubernatorial cycle, right? So.
Yeah, and it happened, 30 years ago now, when the Democrats in their primary, the party people out in the field fell down on the job, and two disciples of Lyndon LaRouche won nominations, one for lieutenant governor. And Adlai Stevenson, who was the Democrat nominee for governor, won the primary, who had lost 4 years earlier by 1,054 votes to Jim Thompson. He resigned the nomination and ran as a third party, Illinois Solidarity Party. And so he lost to Thompson, obviously, but the Solidarity Party got enough support statewide that they became an established party for the next couple cycles.
If I could just I know we don't want to spend too much time on this, but there was a state representative, Urell, and this was cited in the
Buzz Urell from the Southwest Suburbs.
There you go. This was cited in the legislative debate, June 24th, 1983. David Gill and his attorney cited this in their legal documents. He said on the floor, "I'm trying to protect all the members of the House who are down here doing the people's business while somebody's back in your district circulating petitions. And if he has enough time, there won't be any petitions left for you to circulate or sign." So that was sort of the smoking gun. The judge seemed to key in on that during the hearing here in Central Illinois. The case isn't over yet.
All right. And speaking of being a campaign, basically, what a difference a few years makes if you're a Republican candidate for the legislature, because Governor Bruce Rauner has given $16 million, the last number we had there, for those candidates. Amanda Vinicky, I know he wants to make sure that money's spent wisely, but apparently he says he's not that involved in these campaigns.
Yeah, you'd think that he would be keeping a careful eye on his investment, because really that's what it is. It is an investment in the Republican Party that he's hoping to get a return on. And yet the governor has repeatedly been asked, for well over a month now, all right, so what's your involvement in these races? What's your involvement in these races? And he says there is none. He's not involved in any predictions and any strategizing, not out on the campaign trail. That obviously, I think, has made a lot of people wonder if Rauner's nose will grow, because you have not only the money, but further, we have seen time and time again that when a Republican legislator has resigned midterm, and therefore the local GOP establishment gets to choose a replacement, that Rauner has gotten involved. And in various cases, word is that is all but handpicked who that fill-in Republican legislator will be. If you look, for example, in Springfield, it seems that we now have Representative Sarah Wojcicki-Jimenez, thanks to Governor Bruce Rauner, who she had served for Rauner's wife's chief of staff, and moved on from that position to become the state representative. So I guess we will see. He has not really been out on the campaign trail, and that may be not because he's not involved behind the scenes. It may be because Rauner himself isn't all that popular. So just as he's trying to tie Democratic legislators and candidates to the unpopular House Speaker Michael Madigan, it may be that Rauner is keeping his distance in public because he could bring down any of those candidates if they're tied to him. If anybody doesn't, of course, want to read the paper or listen to public radio or look at the campaign disclosures that show those ties.
Brian, let me go to you on this, because let's say that, for sake of argument here, that the governor is involved in these campaigns, and I think there's evidence to show that. Let's say he's involved in some way. I mean, is there anything wrong with that? I mean, Mike Madigan is certainly involved in the Democratic side.
No, I don't think so. I think it is a unique situation, though, in that you know, the governor has shown himself to have a particular interest in getting legislators that are allied with him, as opposed to maybe who local Republican officials want. I mean, he seems to, you know, he went after State Senator Sam McCann, who's from the area just south of Springfield here, State Senator who has a lot of state workers in his district and voted against the governor on a big union bill that the governor despised. And the governor went after him in the primary. And we've seen him give state jobs to other pro-union Republican members of the Illinois House, or at least pro-union may be overstating it, but Republican members who have a lot of state workers and were popular with those state workers and had good relations with the state employee union. So,
I remember George Ryan famously said, and this would have been midway through his term, and he was under a lot of fire. He told Republican lawmakers, I'll come into your district and I'll campaign and I'll be for you if that'll help, and I'll be against you if that'll help.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the bigger question here is, and Amanda had a kind of a neat way to frame this in one of her stories earlier this week, which is this is a man who is a multi-hundred millionaire, who has nine, you know, mansions, condos, ranches scattered around America. And, you know, it kind of defies belief that he, you know, would have been a savvy enough investor and prudent enough with his money to amass that sort of wealth, and yet is going to spend $16 million and just say, eh, whatever happens, happens. And it's just, you know, people can make their own decisions about whether that is a plausible explanation of what's happening.
Well, I suppose if you look at it on a relative basis, that'd be the equivalent of somebody going to a nice restaurant and drop $100 on dinner.
Yeah, well, given how what a small fraction of his annual income $16 million is, yeah.
But I wouldn't tell you what to order.
I think it gets to
be the difference.
Well, I think it gets to this broader question, and you're going to have people that are critics of Rauner no matter what, be it because they are Democrats or, you know, any number of reasons. But this, I think, does give fodder to those that believe that he doesn't tell the truth and have evidence of other times in the past, be it when he talked about his involvement and then lack thereof, but then it was proven that there was involvement in getting his daughter into a special school in the city of Chicago, so on. Those sort of things where when you are in these negotiations and politics, you know, it's supposed to be known as trust is your word. Obviously, there's a difference between what you say on the campaign trail and what you say in closed door rooms. But I think for a lot of people, it just kind of defies belief that you wouldn't have a Republican governor paying $16 million that wouldn't say, yeah, I'm involved. I want Republicans to be elected.
Well, and this is just part of a broader national trend where we've seen truth and spin. The line between those things is just getting blurrier and blurrier in the minds of politicians. And certainly on the national stage, with Donald Trump in particular, who has, you know, repeatedly claimed he was just as one example for the Iraq War, even though there's documentary evidence that he wasn't.
Well, the governor,
that would have been his stand-in doing those interviews way back in 2000. What was it? Two.
Yeah. So, I mean, but this is just something that nationally, you know, it's this goes back even 10 years.
Across party lines.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Bipartisan. But Stephen Colbert coined that truthiness, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is like, well, you know, if a politician says it, you know, there are far fewer reporters than there used to be. They are far less, newsrooms are far less equipped to dedicate, throw people at, you know, fact-checking every statement like this. I think politicians count on the fact that they can get away with a lot.
Well, and there's party lines and then there's state lines, and the governor apparently has enough money to be giving money to other candidates outside of Illinois, including to neighboring Indiana, Republican lieutenant governor there who's running for the governorship, apparently giving about $100,000. Amanda, that came as a little bit of a surprise, especially considering these two states seem to be fighting over jobs and things like that.
Well, right. When you have, again, Governor Rauner saying that he wants all of the jobs that he's got lots of fun little phrases that he uses to talk about his plans, especially when he believes his economic agenda via the turnaround passes, how Illinois will be able to basically steal and win over all of Indiana's companies, his administration and those aides that, you know, though he isn't involved in these Illinois races, he's involved in those evidently because he says that it is in his best interest to promote a quality economic agenda via Republican leadership in other states and across the Midwest. And this may not be the only out-of-state campaign contribution that the governor makes. So we'll be having to continue to watch not just Illinois' campaign finance records, but that of other states as well, maybe over in Missouri, for example, where they've got
a pretty heated governor's race. Democratic Party had an interesting response. They said that what Rauner is really trying to do is to elect Holcomb to continue Mike Pence's policies. Pence left to be Trump's running mate because they failed and Indiana is looking bad, and Rauner wants Holcomb to be elected to continue these policies because it makes Illinois look good.
That's pretty ingenious, I would say.
Yeah. And I kind of wonder if you travel on Interstate 80 up in the just south of the Chicago area, that Indiana has been putting up billboards that say, hey, we passed a budget. Come do business in Indiana. And you kind of wonder, on the one hand, maybe Rauner would like to see those taken down. But on the other hand, it kind of supports his argument to have those up there. So it'll be interesting to see if he gets to weigh in on Indiana policy with his new friend if he's elected.
Well, let's move on to our notes from the field. Charlie, I'll start with you.
Well, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability came out with its annual report on wagering in Illinois, and it said in 2016, tax revenues from various forms of gambling hit $1.3 billion, up almost 4% from 2015. Interestingly, though, the lottery comprises most of it, followed by riverboats, but video gaming has grown from roughly less than 10% 2 years ago to more than 20% in the last year. And on a local note, Springfield has more gaming terminals, video gaming terminals, than any other city in the state of Illinois. Now, of course, Chicago has not allowed them, so take it with a grain of salt.
Brian?
Yeah, we had news from the Illinois Department of Employment Security this week that the state's unemployment rate dropped by about a third to 5.5%. You think that'd be good news, but the officials there in the Rauner administration showed their remarkable ability to reverse engineer lemons from lemonade and pointed out that, the labor force is declining and Illinois lost 46,000 jobs short of its peak employment level reached back in September 2000, before the Great Recession, before 9/11, before the dot-com bust. It'll be interesting to see if the spin on these numbers, which Pat Quinn used to try to spin these numbers too, but if the spin changes as Governor Rauner gears up for re-election in 2 years.
Andy Maloney?
Well, much is made of independent voters and the sway they have every election year, especially presidential election years. But it's not always the case that the candidate who wins the independent voters is going to end up winning the election. Case in point, perhaps, is that a cadre of recent telephone polls from groups such as ABC, Fox, CNN, all have Republican candidate Donald Trump leading among independents. I think the average is around 7 points. However, a lot of polls still show him trailing Hillary Clinton. And over the last 40 years, in the four closest elections, the candidate who won independent voters actually ended up losing the election, including most recently Mitt Romney in 2012.
And Amanda.
Condolences to family and friends of Paul Green, a prolific author, humorist, political analyst who I often interviewed, who passed away last weekend at the age of 73. We'll miss you, Paul.
All right, that will do it for today. Our members of our broadcast include Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Vinicky, Brian Mackey, and our guest today, Andy Maloney with the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org. You can also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. The production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.